We are delighted that Richard Rodriguez is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula. Bill Russell, of course, is here. The sexual reproduction part, when you say how deeply important the erotic part of your growing up in love with, as you characterize it, the wrong gender. Not the wrong gender, the gender that is not generally accepted. Again, this is the sexual reproduction takes elements and puts them together anew. I began to wonder as I read both Days of Obligation, which is also sensational, and Brown, I began to wonder, okay, I'm not going to take America's Not a Salad, that's silly. And then you say, well, maybe it is a melting pot. I began to think maybe it's a Petri dish. And then looking at this notion of sexual reproduction brings new elements together in ways that are utterly unpredictable.
Yes.
Isn't that part of what America's work is?
No, it is. I was created in the 16th century from the meeting of the conquistador and the Indian. And the advantage, it seems to me, that Latin America has always had in this conversation and in answer to your question is that there's always been a sexual candor in Latin America. As compared to the black and white United States, where clearly, you know, we are afraid of the word brown. I mean, we have an actress this year who wins, Halle Berry, who wins an Academy Award, and in the eyes of a Latin American, she's clearly a mulata. But she gets up in front of an audience of Hollywood moguls, and she describes herself as black. We cannot speak of our brownness in this country. We make reference to it. Every African-American friend of mine says somewhere in the course of our friendship, did you know that I'm part American Indian? That I had a great-grandmother who was a Sioux or a Cherokee?
And so am I.
Indeed. And Bill Clinton says that he's 1/16th American Indian. I want to meet her. I've always wanted to meet this woman. But generally speaking, that never factors its way into our political conversation or even to our sense of ourselves as a nation. We take our energies mainly from the sense of our individualism. In that sense, as I describe in my book, there seems to be a dialectic now opening up as the country becomes not simply as we've traditionally been an East-West country, beginning our history on the East Coast and moving west, which is the history we present to our children, but it's becoming more the country that my Mexican father described, the country of El Norte, the country that is now posed between the desert and the tundra, between hot and cold, between Canada and Mexico, the country of NAFTA. When you think of the dialectic that's now beginning to emerge, for me, is that you know the advantage of the cold of the Canadian in this argument is that Canada has established since 1972, Pierre Elliott Trudeau proposed the notion of multiculturalism, the mosaic. That multiculturalism is a humane Canadian solution to the problem of our diversity. And the Canadians came up with this idea based, I think, on their profound respect for the individual, on honoring our difference. You, Paula, and I are not the same person. We will honor our difference. We will even celebrate our difference. The trouble with the Canadian model is that it's not very sexy. People don't fall in love in Canada. They all stay, you know, honoring their difference. And there's never the second act in that drama. Mexico, on the other hand, is a country that has always understood that people fall in love. And Mexico has no notion of multiculturalism. Mexico has the notion of the mestizaje, the meltdown of people, the body piled on bodies, children being born who look like none of their grandparents. In the American classroom now, we are teaching our children the Canadian multiculturalism. But in our schoolyards, the Filipina is flirting with the African. And clearly now there is this dialectic between Canadian water, which is, as we all know, very pure, clean, and Mexican food, which we know is very tasty and bad for us, we say in America. If we would ever combine that notion of the communal life, that of the erotic life, which is the Latin American's intuition, with that respect for the individual, that cool respect of the individual, which is the Canadian Anglo-Saxon model, it seems to me that we would come up with a very sexy Iowa.
And Iowa right now needs all the help it can get.
It does. I was in Iowa the other day. They just declared Iowa safe for the English language, and I came there two weeks too late to tell them that we don't speak English in this country. And the Britons have been trying to tell us that for 100 years. We speak a very brown tongue. We speak American, by which I mean already in the 1850s, Britons were describing Negroisms on the tongue. and American Indian words. And then the great waves of immigration begin, and suddenly German words get added to the tongue, and Italian. And then there's a Mexican-American war, and the Americans take over half of Mexico's territory, but take the vocabulary, too, for the land. Take words like Mesa and Arroyo and Rio, and then take words for the cities. So there is no way to speak this tongue that I am now using without speaking Spanish or German, or as somebody, one of my critics said to me the other day, he called me a schmuck. There's no way to speak this tongue without speaking Yiddish too.
Yeah.
It sounds, you know, listening to you, it seems the metaphor is almost one of ecologies. I mean, we tend to create these little boxes. The black, the white, and now we got another box that is brown. But this is a rich ecology, and it seems that that metaphor allows for the eroticism that you speak of. It allows for the sexiness that you speak of. It allows for change. It allows for integration. It allows for at least evolutionary progress.
Yes. I don't want brown to be the third box. It seems to me that, you know, I keep telling people that I am not literally brown, I am orange. And some of the brownest people I know are, you know, have blonde hair and blue eyes. Brown is not a literal color. It is what gets created when cultures combine, religions combine, conflicted nations combine within a single child. And it is not an easy color. Before September 11th, I would have come here and said today, celebrate brown. We are seeing something in the world. The last time I was here in Atlanta, I met a girl who said that she was a Korean African. And I said, that's nice. And then she said, but that's not half of it. She said, the other. I said, what's the other half? She said, I'm a Baptist Buddhist. And then she says to me what a lot of brown children say in America, and that is that neither grandmother accepts me. My Korean grandmother says I'm too African. My African grandmother says I'm too Korean. And I live as a brown child in the middle zone. And I was in Seattle talking to a very tiresome theologian, and I said I had met a Korean. I'd met a Baptist Buddhist in Atlanta. He said, that's impossible. There's no such thing as a Baptist Buddhist. And I said, but she walks. She has an address. She has a smile. Before September 11th, I would have said, these children are going to reconstruct the world. But I also realize now that there are dangerous brown children, or brown could be a dangerous color. The child who grows up at war with his own complexity. I think of Osama bin Laden, you know, the cosmopolite, the upper-class Saudi child who's multilingual, whose family vacations in Geneva. There he is in one of our magazines in a silk suit at the age of 14, smiling at the camera at the age of 14 in front of the Beau Rivage Hotel. By the time he is 16, already he's beginning to go to war against his brownness. He wants to be only one color. He wants to be a straight line, not a crooked line. He wants to be a Muslim among other Muslims, not among Christians and atheists. He wants to live in a cave with other men of exactly his disposition. It seems to me, as you go around this country, which is growing brown indeed, that children may become frightened of their own complexity and may seek out a cafeteria table of people exactly like themselves. We'll sit only with other kids who listen to hip-hop. We'll sit only with other kids who are queer. We'll sit only with other kids who are Mormon like themselves. You go into American cafeterias and you see the brown world in its totality, but you also see very separate cafeteria tables.
This is a great time. It's what you were saying. This is a time of great transition. Part of the challenge is we have so many choices that we are essentially in the position of creating ourselves every day. If you then take this disclaiming that you describe, where the parents disclaim these children, you lose that cultural continuity, that tribal continuity. So they are cut off not only from their broader heritage, but from their familial heritage. They are left then to look around them at what is essentially a smorgasbord of values, of self-evaluation, of evaluation of their communities. It seems for us to get through that, there need to be some very clear-sighted people, and maybe this is the role of the public intellectual, that can give us some proto-myth, some proto-vision.
It's almost as if we need a cushion in all of this, what sounds quite brittle, that we need some way not to break.
Yeah. I keep thinking, you know, to get back to the metaphor of the desert religions, those three great religions that most Americans adhere to, they are all communal religions. fiercely communal, and yet we live in a culture in America that is Hellenistic, that sees its energies as primarily individualistic. That tension between the I, the Greek I, and the Hebraic we, it seems to me to be a great unresolved tension in this country. It could be ultimately a source of great creativity, but it leads many children, I think, to despair, because they don't understand. Their sense of themselves as I people is always, in their own mind, often associated with a kind of rebellion against the we, and they don't realize that in fact their I comes to them communally. It comes to them as a cultural value.
They have permission to be.
That's right, and that in fact they were given that pronoun by slaves and by slave owners and by Thomas Jefferson and by Abraham Lincoln. And that there are within this conflict between these two pronouns, it seems to me, some way to teach the child to be both, but it's a very difficult thing to live.
You also say, and we'll pick back up when we return, you also say, you quote someone saying, America is not individuals, it's loneliness.
Yes.
And addressing some of that is part of what we'll come back together to do in a moment when we return. Richard Rodriguez is our guest. Bill Russell is here. I'm Paula Gordon. The three of us invite you to return with us.